Hi everyone, welcome to another of our virtual ILS Asia 2021 event broadcasts. Please do visit the event website for details of our current sponsors, and you can see the full agenda there and also access some of the earlier sessions on demand now as well. So last year we held a session during the equivalent event last July featuring three pension investors who discussed a range of issues that matter and what they look for in their ILS investments and investment manager partnerships as well. And this year, I'm delighted to have the three same investors back again in 2021 to hear some of their updated thoughts on the ILS asset class. So with me today, I have Evelyn Takensomas, Senior Director and Lead Portfolio Manager of the Insurance Portfolio at PGGM. We have Bernard van der Stichel, Portfolio Manager for ILS and Fixed Income and Derivatives at the Healthcare of Ontario Pension Plan, and also Craig Dandurand, Head of Debt at the Future Fund of Australia. So thank you all for joining me today.
Good to be here, Steve.
Thank you for inviting us. Yeah. Thank you.
Indeed. Sure. So for this live panel session, we're going to take a bit of a rapid fire trip through some of the issues that matter to large institutional investors in 2021. And for those watching, we will have time for some audience Q&A as well, so please do use the box on the screen in front of you. Take this opportunity to gain insights from some experienced investors allocating to ILS. So the first issue I'd like to discuss is the pandemic, as COVID is still something we can't ignore and continues to present some challenges in different areas of the world. And the situation is obviously much improved in most countries, but travel remains challenging. And I know this affects obviously the ability and ease of allocating sometimes. Obviously, everything's virtual these days. So, Evelyn, starting with you, how has the last year been for running the ILS allocations at PGGM? And has the pandemic thrown up any specific challenges for you?
Hi, Steve, and hello to all of you from the Netherlands. So PGGM took a very practical approach towards investing during the pandemic. We transitioned from on-site due diligence towards online due diligence without compromising on quality. Of course, this is easier with parties that you visited before or you have an existing relationship, and it also takes more effort with parties that are new to you. Overall, I can say that we had positive experiences. We added three new investments to our insurance portfolio, two with existing partners and one with a new partner. I believe that we can continue to work like this for a little bit longer, but I look forward to meeting people face-to-face. And also for the future, I wish us to kind of have a healthy balance between online and face-to-face meetings. Other than that, real challenges.
It's good to hear that you managed to make new allocations during a period like this, because I know it's been difficult, and I think we all want to get back to some type of normal, but perhaps not quite as much travel as it was previously for some of you. I'm sure you spent a lot of time on planes, and while the air miles are always attractive, it's not great for work-life balance, perhaps. Bernard, moving on to you, how did the remote nature of interactions sort of affect your allocation process? Has it made it any more challenging, or have you similarly found it easy to adapt?
I think that the transition has been fairly simple and painless for myself personally. I think, you know, the due diligence process, yes, has taken a bit of a different turn in that everything has been online or via video calls. But overall, I'm pretty happy with how it turned out. No major issues encountered. But I'll definitely also look forward to meeting, you know, our partners and potential partners face-to-face, and being able to speak to them directly and meet their teams, et cetera, in the near future, hopefully.
Yes, we definitely all look forward to that. Finally, Craig, you're perhaps the furthest removed from the established ILS markets, I suppose, being down in Australia. And you also cover a range of other asset classes at the Future Fund as well. What do you think about the last year? Has it hindered your progress at all, do you feel? And also, how do you feel the ILS managers you speak with have adapted to this new world?
I think the adaptation over a short to medium term basis has been fine. We haven't been looking to go off and add a range of new managers to any of the mandates that, that I and my team oversee, whether it's in insurance-linked securities or debt or elsewhere. Although we across the broader future fund, we were able to add a couple of new managers to the platform even without meeting them in person. But that usually came from an environment of, let's say, implied credibility, if you will, where we had enough partners who had worked with those managers that we felt that perhaps in those instances of face-to-face interaction wasn't a necessary precondition to investing. At the same time, I think that over a longer span of time, if we're thinking 2, 3, 4 years of this, would we want to be operating in a totally virtual environment? I think the answer is no. I think you miss out on a lot of the softer features of a relationship. I think you miss out on getting context. There's something about being on the island, about being in Bermuda for several days that you just pick up things and you see nuances that you just can't pick up no matter how much acuity you apply to the process online. So it's good. It's been good, but it isn't perfect. And I think the sooner we can get back to being able to safely move around the planet, the better off we're going to be as investors and as partners.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point as well, Craig. You mentioned going sort of on the ground in Bermuda and places like that, and without visiting sort of London, Lloyd's, Bermuda, the real hubs of insurance and reinsurance, it's kind of difficult to get a feel for the industry from a remote basis, I guess. And especially when you're trying to get a feel for the ILS piece of the industry, which is one step perhaps removed from some of those markets as well. But on the subject of COVID, there's obviously the other side to it, which has been the threat of losses to the insurance and reinsurance industry, which I think we're currently somewhere up over $30 billion of sort of realized losses so far. But there's been concern over collateral being trapped for the ILS industry because of pandemic-related business interruption. And that concern seemed to peak before the January renewals, but then tailed off a little bit, and so far seems to have been relatively minimal to date. But still, the industry seems to talk about there being potential exposure there for some people, and I thought it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on this. And so, Evelyn, I was going to ask you first, do you feel you have good visibility of this potential issue and any possible exposure for your investments? Is it any kind of concern still, do you feel?
Yeah, there are definitely concerns. So the BI losses due to COVID itself remain a concern to us. It has to do with the unexpected nature of these losses, which I find the most which I personally find the most challenging to communicate with our senior management and also our board members. This is something they were not expecting, and hence it requires quite a lot of explanation. Also, when you invest in the full spectrum of ILS instruments, such as bonds, collateralized reinsurance, and quota shares, it is hard to not be exposed. I think we have pretty good visibility on business interruption exposure in our investments. We receive regular updates from all of our partners. I can say the level of transparency that they provide here on this particular topic is good. And as we work with more than 10 partners, I believe that we have quite a complete overview of the topic. So I think from that perspective, everything fine. On the losses itself, given the moderate risk profile of our portfolio and its focus on the US, I don't expect significant losses from now, but I think it will take a couple of more years to have this certainty, and that's the element that I kind of dislike. On trapped collateral, personally, that's less of a concern. Most of our investments have a very efficient rollover of collateral to the next risk period, so we're not that much bothered by trapped collateral.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned 2 years, because obviously that's aligned with sort of how long it can take for a major catastrophe to develop. But this was something that was obviously quite uncertain when it happened, and the exposure took a while to even manifest, let alone the losses. So it's a challenging one there, but good to hear you're not feeling too exposed to it. Bernard, you also allocate to private deals, I think, as well as to ILS fund managers. Do you feel you're getting enough clarity on the COVID BI issue?
Yes, I think sort of after the fact, after the event, where I'm getting fairly good transparency and clarity on the remaining issues, and as Evelyn mentioned, the uncertainty is really the factor that is the most difficult to manage, because you're really not sure how long that trapped capital is going to be trapped for. But I would say that overall, our partners are being, very good at updating us with developments with respect to COVID-related BI losses or potential losses. So again, going back to what Evelyn said at the beginning, the unexpected, the unexpected nature of BI losses and COVID is really, I think, what is more disturbing. Right. As when we invest in ILS, we're looking to invest in, U.S. wind risk, for example, or another peak peril. We're not looking to invest in or provide cover for pandemic risk. Sometimes we are, but, we want to know exactly what we're investing in. And so the fact that there were pandemic related losses in contracts that were not supposed to take that risk on is definitely troubling. And I think that's where the industry needs to kind of improve itself a little bit in terms of, again, either, explaining to investors that there are still unmodeled risks, or there are sort of secondary risks that are implicitly taken by a lot of these contracts, or to the cedents in terms of, ring fencing the risks that are being transferred that are being covered by a particular contract, and why certain type of risk or clause cannot be included in the contract. So these are things to be worked out, I think.
Mm. And I guess in this case, you're also taking on some risk of litigation. And obviously litigation in different parts of the world can go very different directions as well. So that just adds another layer right. of uncertainty.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bernard. Craig, so you allocate through ILS fund managers. Is this a topic you're being kept up to speed on regularly? And do you feel you're getting enough comfort that the industry actually understands the potential exposure here?
I think, yes, we're being up to, so I'll go back and, one item of clarification there, Steve, just to make clear, we don't invest directly with but we do invest through managers. So we don't have our own portfolio of cat bonds, for example. At the Future Fund, we can't actually directly invest that way. The communication's been very good. I think that we've been in this long enough now, doing this for 6 years, that you sort of, all right, something bad in the world happened. Let's see where that hits the portfolio. It doesn't necessarily even need to be a big storm anymore that does that. But that's sort of the nature of this particular beast. If you've got enough, if you write enough lines of cover, some of them are going to get hit. And for reasons that you probably, you may not have fully understood going in, regrettably enough. That's the way that the documentation behind policies is drafted. It's a sort of a constant learning experience, if you will, of, okay, there's a risk that we hadn't fully underwritten. It's frustrating and it can be fatiguing, but at the same time, business interruption is generally part of a lot of these policies. That's the way it goes. But it doesn't make it any more fun, that's for sure. So I think we're getting very good information about that. There are so many moving parts with respect to this, even as we're sitting here right now, all in the comfort of our own homes, in varying states of lockdown and various stages of vaccination and so on. You could very well have incidents occur that haven't been completed yet, litigation that hasn't been completed yet. Government funding, if you will, of businesses was a form of subrogation, I guess you could say, last year, or a form of protection that came through for a lot of businesses. So the extent to which that the pandemic added additional levels of complexity to an asset class, which on its face is very simple and easy to understand, but in practice can be very complex. It is the unfortunate nature of this beast. And I think it's sort of a perpetual challenge of trying to make sure that we're as aware of those risks as possible. But at the same time, knowing that we'll never fully be, able to, with incredible granularity, get down to each and every risk that we have or don't have.
Yeah, and what about the industry's potential exposure? Do you feel the managers you work with have got a handle on that yet?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they definitely do. I think that at the same time, you could absolutely see a scenario where we're not done yet, right? We're not done yet. And so if you have a risk that attaches, even as in the industry undoubtedly has done better this year at circumscribing pandemic than it had in previous years from many of the policies that are being written. But it's not a sure thing. It's not a sure thing. We're not done with this yet. And so sort of knowing is half the battle, I guess you could say. But the other half probably is good documentation.
Yeah, absolutely. Documenting it up front seems to be the way to address this, at least to a degree. So let's move on from COVID and the pandemic and move on to the other sort of hottest topic in the world right now. Really has to be climate change. It's something that you can't really talk to any investor without them expressing opinion and concern and direction for their portfolios related to climate at the moment. And there's a lot going on in the insurance and reinsurance industry. I mean, just this morning we covered the announcement of a net zero alliance of insurers and reinsurers, which got eight of the largest companies saying they're going to transition their underwriting portfolios to net zero by 2050, which sounds meaningful, but is that fast enough for the ILS market and for the investors who want ESG appropriate investments there? Craig, when we were discussing this year's event, planning for it, you said the top issue for you is climate. Perhaps you could expand on that and let our viewers know how you feel the ILS market is doing at addressing the climate question.
That was enough right there. I'll just keep screaming the word often enough and see if it works. I think on the one hand, I think that the industry is getting better and better every year at figuring out climate change and their real world applications, if you will, of that to risk management. The sense to which certain perils are being obviously linked to climate change than others. I think when I started out in this 7 years ago, the questions were largely about hurricane risk. And I think within that particular scope that you could have arguments being made about whether climate change was leading to sea surface conditions that made hurricanes of a certain velocity more or less likely. I think in the last few years, as we've seen wildfire frequency grow, particularly in my home state of California, but elsewhere in areas where you've got a combination, if you say, of climate conditions as well as essentially third party accelerants to that, if you will, right? Perhaps infrastructure that hasn't been as well maintained as it needs to be in an environment where you're going to have more lightning strikes and more dry tinder. That awareness that perhaps there are certain risks that you simply cannot effectively underwrite on a reinsurance basis becomes more and more prevalent. And so the idea of at the inception of, okay, there's got to be a buffer around this risk when it's underwritten, does that buffer get even larger now? And if so, what price point is too much to actually enable that to be done on a purely private sector basis? These are questions that have to be addressed. So it's a market that we continue to allocate to. But it's the one, and there's an irony in the sense that people tend to look at this one and put the whole emphasis on climate around this in the ILS sector, failing to realize all of the other things that are being insured, all the other businesses, the houses, the communities. If it wasn't an issue for us, it wouldn't be an issue for them, if you will. The fact that it is an issue for us means it's also an issue for them. But it's just very easy, I think, for people to focus down on a climate as being the issue solely within ILS. But there's still an awful lot of wood. It's a bad analogy to use in this context, but there's a lot of wood to chop here. We're not there yet. And so figuring out how to quantify this effectively continues to be an ongoing challenge.
Yes, it certainly does. I think there's obviously steps being taken in terms of technology to understand risk better, but it seems there's a lot of work to do before you can give any sort of certainty to anyone that climate is fully accounted for within pricing, it seems. Evelyn, given the significant focus on climate across institutional circles, the industry often responds to the climate question by saying that its contracts are repriced on an annual basis or they're very short term, but do you think that's a sufficient answer for trustees and board members going forwards, or do you think they want to hear more detail, more granular information about how climate is being accounted for and priced for as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's only part of a not so great answer. I believe that climate change should be much better addressed and should also be on top of mind of every ILS investor. So if you're talking about basically the annual resets of contracts, I believe that the models are lagging reality. So the industry typically first need to witness an event or a series of events before they start to adjust the models. Like Greg mentioned, I think this also happened for the US wildfires that started in 2017. So I would say the industry is more maybe reactive than proactive. And that's definitely an angle that they, given the fact that they know so much, they're really on top of the of this asset class with so much knowledge that they should take advantage of that. In addition, I believe that climate change, I don't believe it's appropriately priced for. So if you look at pricing, it's still mainly driven by demand and supply of coverage, and investors and reinsurance companies have plenty of capital to invest in at this moment. And I think this supply of capital is slowing down adequate pricing, kind of adequate long-term pricing. So I think we're not there yet. There's definitely room for improvement regarding climate change.
Yes. And do you get a lot of questions about climate when you talk to your trustees or board of the pension you invest for? It's still one of their top questions, I assume.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of, I would say, a standard part of our presentations towards our boards. It's definitely maybe even the top three topic of ILS investing.
Mm, yeah. And moving to you, Bernard, Evelyn just mentioned there about sort of annual contracts, but whether the models actually keep up with that to give you the comfort that you're pricing, or whether the industry is actually lagging behind there. Now you've got some experience from the modeling world in your career, but how well do you feel ILS and also the broader reinsurance industry answers the climate question? And when you interact with cedents and managers, are they able to give you comfort that they're accounting for it?
You know, I don't think anyone right now is really giving comfort in terms of being able to deal with, you know, physical climate risk and the pricing for it. I agree with Evelyn and Craig that the industry is lagging behind, and the sort of the commercial vendor platforms are lagging behind. But at the same time, it is a very challenging subject, and so you know, I think you know, everyone is really working at it. You know, I would say, you know, most of our partners do have sort of dedicated expertise and sort of science teams that are able to take commercial cat risk models and make adjustments to take into account changing climate risk. But again, it's very challenging, and I think it will take years to be able to say, yes, we are satisfied that we can price climate risk appropriately. It's a tough one. And, you know, I would say that, you know, everyone in the industry taking on, you know, property cat risk, you know, really needs to own risk. I know it's an often used phrase, but I think that's what it comes down to. You have to, you know, make your own assessment of the risk and build a framework for yourself with respect to timescale, you know, short-term versus long-term. You know, contracts are priced on a short-term basis, but an ILS investor such as a pension fund is going to look at the asset class with a long-term view. And so not only do I have to ensure that I can price climate risk into transactions or investments, at least, you know, to some extent, but also have to provide assurance to Hoop's board that the asset class is going to be paying in accordance to the risk that we're taking on. So it involves a number of sort of timescales. and that needs to be kept in mind as well.
Mm. And yeah, I think you're right that it's something that managers and those putting together deals need to really demonstrate their conviction behind them and their science and their view of risk as well, don't they? It kind of drives home the fact that you can't just rely on a few vendor models, and you've got to have deeper insights into this. And I suppose that also requires the industry to scale out over time to have this scientific expertise behind it too.
That's right, yeah. And you know, after every significant event, the question always comes up: is this caused by climate change? And it's a very hard one to answer. I don't think the sort of attribution science is really, it's in its infancy, and those are very difficult questions to answer. And so the following question is: how do you take that new information now and apply it to our modeling framework? Is it a new data point, or how do you deal with it? And all these things are questions that are being worked out, I think.
It's still a challenging issue for the industry, I think, right the way up from the primary insurer. But when we think about obviously climate, it's one component of an investment being sort of ESG appropriate, is thinking that it at least covers or factors in climate in its pricing and mitigates against it potentially as well. And ESG is obviously a topic that's incredibly sort of high profile right now on top of the agenda for the ILS market in terms of those delivering investments to people like yourselves. But it's also obviously a big issue for the investors as well, who want to allocate more of their capital to things that are ESG appropriate. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on its importance to you within your ILS allocations, or perhaps whether the broader organization covers ESG and ILS is something with maybe a little less focus than some areas. Starting with you, Craig, ESG is obviously top of mind for the ILS managers, but do you feel it's being addressed in a meaningful way that actually will make a difference to someone like the Future Fund?
It's a bit up in the air, I think, just through an ILS-specific lens, right? Our philosophy around ESG is that we expect our managers to incorporate ESG considerations as part of their stock standard risk management process. And if they don't, we're assuming that they are missing key component parts that would impact the economic risk and return of an asset or an asset class. How that extends into the ILS realm, as is true, I think, with any set of ESG considerations, is kind of in the eye of the beholder. I tend to think of ILS as actually, process that leads to the sustainability of many other exercises. So the idea that, and so what we don't really do with our portfolios is say that we must have an ESG compliant ILS portfolio or an ESG compliant debt portfolio. We tend not to pursue a policy of exclusions. It's more of a policy of continuous improvement. So we're not, as a matter of course, looking at things that are ESG label on them. I think I actually have a reasonable degree of skepticism around what it means when an ESG label is attached to a particular issue, whether it's in the cap bond realm or far more broadly in the general corporate bond realm. So it's something that we're aware of, a situation where we're going to be laying down essentially a gauntlet saying, thou shalt not insure at any level risk. I don't think that kind of granularity is saying, well, we could certainly pursue it and certainly work on that with our managers. I don't think it's something that we're likely to do in the near term. I think the focus is around just improving, and the climate change analysis that we just talked about, I think, is itself the most cogent and crucial part of the ESG analysis of the ILS sector.
Yeah, that's interesting, and interesting that you mentioned labels there as well, because obviously it's very hard to really label something in the ILS market as fully ESG compliant, because the lack of transparency looking through the layers of transactions right the way down to individual insurance policy holders is very hard to provide up to an investor, I guess, as well. Evelyn, I'd be interested to hear from sort of the PGGM side of the world, how you think about ESG in your overall ILS allocation, and then perhaps also referring to your joint venture reinsurer Vermeer as well. Do you expect to adopt an ESG underwriting guideline for it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Steve. So I can say that PGGM has been a front runner on ESG and really believes that financial and sustainable returns go hand in hand. ESG is incorporated in many aspects of our overall portfolio. And today, this is less so the case for the insurance portfolio, as we believe that the industry is just catching up on this topic. And only since recently, serious efforts are made to implement ESG in the underwriting process. I would say the easy parts have been implemented. So we do have an exclusion policy, for example, and we translated that exclusion policy to be implemented across all of our insurance partners. Also, ESG is incorporated as part of kind of collateral and asset side, but that's a relatively easy thing to do. And then it gets harder because then you're getting closer to the underwriting process. And I don't think that the industry has implemented ESG as part of the underwriting process yet. Also, to my knowledge, ESG is not a standard topic during renewals or due diligence meetings between cedents and reinsurers. And we're also similar to Greg. We're externally managed, meaning that we work with either reinsurance partners or ILS fund managers. And we believe that in order to have more influence, it's better to start with the people that you can have actually have an influence on. So and that's typically where you have a direct relationship. So we also have been scoring our partners on protracted set of ESG factors for the last 3 years. And we definitely expect to broaden that. We're a strong believer in ESG as PGGM, and we will continue to put a lot of emphasis and efforts into the topic. We'll make sure that we set it on all the agenda of our partners. And actually, I do expect us to come up with underwriting guidelines across all of our investments in a relative short period of time. Not per se Vermeer itself. I think we roll that out across all at a similar time frame.
Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think ILS investors putting their own guidelines on things and becoming stricter about what they will allocate to, I think will be another motivator for change across the broader reinsurance industry as well. And things are beginning to change there, it seems, with this commitment from some of the biggest reinsurers, at least to net zero as well. So moving on to you, Bernard.
I agree.
Great. So moving on to Bernard, one of the challenges is, as Evelyn and Craig as well have both mentioned, is the underwriting side. And it's very difficult to look through a reinsurance or retrocession contract to really see what lies underneath. And I know some of the really big ESG allocators of the world, their sort of mantra is that they want their investments to demonstrably do no harm. And it seems ILS just would be very difficult for them to confirm that with the way the market is today. But what do you think about ESG compliance and transparency for your investments, Bernard? And do you think this is something the industry is going to be able to resolve anytime soon?
I think it will take some time for the industry to catch up with other sectors, perhaps, in terms of knowing how to handle ESG factors. So yes, you're correct in that transparency is sometimes difficult with respect to understanding who or what business sort of the underlying cedents are engaged in. For myself, I think, I'm at a point where I think I cover ESG by really engaging with our partners and having those discussions in trying to understand how they look to account for ESG issues, et cetera. But again, I think it's a developing process that will take some time to be robust. I will definitely say that I'm definitely not a fan of sort of ESG labels, especially with respect to certain cat bond issuances. I understand that some investors who have perhaps stricter guidelines with respect to what they are allowed to invest in, for those investors, those labels might matter. But we always look to see through those labels and see what really materially what is really underneath underneath that, and is it meaningful? So I think that's where we stand. But as a whole, I mean, I definitely want to confirm that Hoop is really very serious about ESG matters, and has developed an ESG framework, which really allows it to be a responsible investor, and that is only going to get more and more significant across the fund, not just ILS.
Yeah, and that does seem to be the trend with most major investors. And I think in ILS, it is going to take time. And clearly, this net zero commitment of some of the largest insurers and reinsurers is a target date of 2050 for them to decarbonize their underwriting portfolios. So that's quite a way off, obviously, before that factors into an ILS investment. So
I think in a way, Steve.
Go ahead, Craig.
I was just going to say that one of the frustrations I have with a 2050 target is that I believe pretty much everybody on this call is going to be retired by then, and that's my struggle with it is that setting targets that are actually achievable within the time frame of those that are setting the targets might be just feel a little bit more substantial. If the reality of net zero is impossible to come by something that is, let's get within the realm of the possible. It just feels like a better way to go. I understood the intentions are good. I think the probability of meaningful progress does not come from putting a label on, nor does it come from putting a target on, well beyond the use by date of most of our careers.
Yes, that's a very good point, Craig. And sorry, Bernard, were you going to add something?
Yeah, one last point. When we talk about ESG, I think we shouldn't forget that, the S&G components, the social and governance components of ESG, and I think those are very important. The governance and the behavior of insurers and reinsurers is definitely of importance to us and things that we pay attention to.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think there's a strong social aspect, obviously, to disaster risk financing in general, which most of the ILS market is. Sorry, Evelyn, were you going to mention something there?
I was going to mention that I do believe that the ILS market has progressed more on the S and the G, maybe than compared to the E. So I would say that over the years, the level of transparency within the ILS market increased. And also in a way, alignment is something that's typically also well addressed. So I believe these steps have been made, maybe less so for the E component.
Yes, I think the E is the most difficult aspect, isn't it? It seems. So let's move on, and I guess we should really talk about pricing in the market at some point in our discussion today. And while reinsurance has firmed, and we're now looking at obviously compound rate increases in the mid-year, but perhaps not as high as some people would have liked. And ILS rates are certainly firmer than they were a couple of years ago, but we're now seeing some relatively significant softening in cat bonds and also in ILWs as well. Evelyn, start with you. Do you have any concerns that this is going to spill over to broader collateralized and traditional reinsurance?
Yes, a bit, I would say. I expect the search for yield to continue, leading to increased capital inflows from both ILS investors as well from reinsurance capital. And this will reduce returns over time to kind of unsustainable levels as currently seen in the cat bond market. I kind of strongly hope that the recent lost years that it stays in people's memory for a bit longer than just one or 2 years. As you all know, investing in cat comes with an extreme left tail, which should be adequately priced for. And in a way, you need to create a buffer in good years to compensate for the bad years. And if you cannot create this buffer, then you have a losing strategy. So it really means that sustainable price or sustainable rates are really required in order to make this strategy long-term work. And then we have not even accounted for climate change. That's still also a big question mark. I think for us, this, for PDGM, this really means that we continue to spend a lot of time on efficiency in terms of cost and structure in order to minimize frictional cost and to keep and influence returns to a level that we can really have impact to.
Mm. And I suppose for an investor, it would be pretty disappointing to see rates return to their softest point of a few years ago, given the lost years plus climate, which you'd expect to be bringing up the baseline, and when costs in the industry haven't really come down very far in that amount of time either. So you'd be expecting a new baseline at the least.
Definitely. I think that for us, it should be a requirement, because otherwise it doesn't really matter. Then long term, the strategy is not viable. And I think that's what we should all look after.
Mm. Yeah, that's a strong message for the industry. Craig, turning to you, if it does soften a bit more in reinsurance and private ILS, do you think the overall return potential of the asset class is still a little better than prior years, thanks to all the work done on terms and conditions at the renewals of the last few years? Or do you fear those gains eventually could be lost too if there is a significant inflow of capital?
I'm always concerned. I think that's our job. We're talking about an area where your upside is capped. There is no way to sort of BS yourself into thinking, hey, I'm going to double my money in this sector. So in the face of that, figuring out where you're going to get hit, where you're going to get hit for unexpected or undesired, particularly undesirable reasons, is a key part of that. Yes, certainly all indications are that pricing has improved for 4 years. All indications are that terms and conditions have improved for 4 years. That's 3 years. That's good news. And that's particularly apparent when you are comparing the spreads that are at least on offer in this market with those that are offer in my day job, if you will, in the credit markets, where you've got plenty of evidence now that a typical run rate, quote unquote, high yield bond right now may very well have a negative real yield. And so if you're thinking about it on an asset class versus asset class basis, the fact that this is an area that that you can get yourself set, if you will, only a couple of times a year, that you don't have continuing issuance, if you will, into this market, in July, in August, in September, every month, sort of, a drumbeat, if you will, knocking down spreads and bringing the market down and bringing terms down. It does give the market an ability to stabilize, at least for a period, that the credit markets don't necessarily offer you. So that can be a degree of comfort, but it's also matched with the same concern that Evelyn pointed to, which is that in turn, you don't need necessarily that much incremental capital coming in to put a thumb on the market, scale and push it down in a way that affects most actors. So that concern is always there. But the good news is that concern won't actually, for the collateralized market, for the private market, won't actually come to fruition until January, until Jan 1. And so at least you've got a few months of saying, okay, whatever we have in place is priced better than it would have been the previous year. And in most of the credit markets in which I operate, that absolutely cannot be said the same of.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. We must always think about the broader picture when we're talking to large allocators. Some people would say that the ILS market has a lower cost of capital, and so can perhaps should accept a lower return, particularly in the more liquid cap bond market, it seems. But Bernard, how do you view that? And do you expect to be compensated like any other reinsurance capital provider for taking on the risk?
Oh, I definitely expect to be compensated as well as any smart reinsurer in market. I don't see any reason why not. I share everything that Craig and Evelyn have said about pricing. And I think we have to remember that ILS is usually a fairly small allocation within any institutional investment portfolio. And it could definitely be very, very much scaled back down to zero if necessary, if other asset classes provide more attractive risk-adjusted returns. So pricing is, we are all, I think, very sensitive to pricing. I do hope that the market sort of comes to its senses in terms of softening pricing in terms and conditions and that trend reverses.
Yeah, and what do you feel about the expense base of the industry and the cost of the transaction itself? Is it still need to come down? Do you think there's too much sort of spent in the intermediation process as risks flow along the chain?
Yes, I do think so. It's very hard looking at, comparing deals. There is definitely a limit on the transparency. And so when you're looking at an embedded fee, being able to dissect it and really understand how it comes about is not always easy. But I definitely think, it goes back to the motivation for a particular transaction. Is it motivated as a fee generator, or is it motivated as an actual necessary tool that the cedent is looking to use? I do believe that, transaction costs are still relatively high. Mm. And you have to be very sort of careful what those costs are. Yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely. Thank you, Bernard. So just a reminder to our audience that you can submit some questions if you want to, and we'll get to them shortly before we end the session. But while we're still on the subject of pricing, I thought it'd be interesting to hear if you think the market has begun to price better for some of the more challenging aspects and the uncertainties that have emerged over recent years. And perhaps first, Craig, going to turn to you and ask, do you think the industry is dealing with pricing in Florida more responsibly now, or is there still more work to do in that particular location?
I think the answer to that is yes and yes. It's definitely more responsible. I think the cynic could probably say, how could it have been less responsible? For a spell there, but at the same time, that may be a function of market conditions, right? And the sense to, look, if there's a lot of capital coming in, what are they going to do with it, right? There was a lot of capital coming in to take out players. There was, they were very thinly capitalized, and that this industry was more than happy to reinsure those folks and put them in a position where in some of those cases, those takeout carriers had what amounted to a lottery ticket. Is that prudent underwriting from the standpoint of what your counterparty risk looks like, where the cedent doesn't care, that's risky. I think the extent to which we're still talking about assignment of benefits issues, legal issues, things coming off of Irma, multiple years after the fact, tell us that is a risk profile that hasn't been fully addressed, either perhaps by the insurance and reinsurance industry or by regulators and legislators in Florida. That simply isn't all the way there yet. And so in turn, you're talking about a Florida lawyer buffer that you've got to put into your pricing. Is that adequately compensated? And again, the way that I tend to think about these things, are we adequately compensated? Never. But I think that, the improvements are noticeable. The improvements are pleasing. The fact that we're still in this market, the fact that we're still in ILS, presupposes that we're satisfied with the improvements in the market in Florida. That is a gigantic part of the risk profile for the ILS industry as a whole. If we weren't happy with what was happening in Florida, or at least we probably wouldn't be in the market.
Yeah, that's a great point, Craig. Evelyn, similar question for you, but perhaps a little more broadly across the market. Do you feel the industry's pricing better for the risk of collateral getting trapped, Is that something you feel is accounted for? And similarly, are the terms enhancements that you've seen in underwriting over recent years and then your history in the industry, do you think this is making deals better priced? Is it accounting for some of the uncertainty that you've seen emerge?
Well, I don't think that the industry is pricing better for the risk of collateral trapping actually. In our case, and I think also in many other cases, we have been solving for it as part of our investment structures. And also next to that, we have incorporated continuance capital fees as part of our structure. So if you trap it, then you pay a penalty if it's more than we kind of agree to on. I don't expect non-catastrophe risk to be reflected as part of the pricing in catastrophe reinsurance, not to a huge extent. Some people price for it. I think that's the minority. So if you want to improve, I think the better way to go about it is in terms and conditions. We have seen exclusions that were really in favor. Also, we've seen companies excluding COVID losses. So I think there you can have most influence, and here it is where we can protect investor interest.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Bernard, moving to you, as an investor, are you looking to maximize your returns at the potential expense of taking on more volatility, or are you trying to deliver stable returns to your allocations? And how has the environment changed in the last 2 years in this respect? Is it now more favorable either way, do you think?
Well, keep in mind, Hoop has really only been in the ILS market for a bit more than a year now. You know, I think, again, it really depends on what you mean by volatility, but, you know, yes, there is a certain element of sort of tactical thinking in terms of our ILS strategy, whereby, you know, we might seek out a higher return, risk-adjusted return at certain times if conditions are right. But overall, it's, you know, the objective of the strategy is really to provide a non-correlated or low-correlation return stream to the fund that works together with its other strategies. So it's one element in a much, much bigger portfolio. So I hope that answers your question.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Bernard. So we've actually got a question from the audience that it would be really relevant to take now. And somebody's asking if every panelist could make one change to the reinsurance terms and conditions that they're subject to, what change would you make? Let's ask Evelyn first. Is there a specific area of terms and conditions you'd like to change now?
Yeah, definitely. I would say remove all non-catastrophe risks in full from the catastrophe reinsurance market. I think that would make our life, investors' life, a lot easier. It would avoid negative surprises because the majority are still coming from that area, which in a way would help, I would say, the natural catastrophe cat strategy.
Mm. And surely help to get more capital deployed into catastrophe risk, which the world really needs as well.
I think so, yes. I think it would make a lot of things easier, and therefore it's a great idea.
Mm. And Craig, is there an area of terms and conditions that you'd like to see adjusted?
Well, Evelyn took the number one, the number one answer off the board there. I think that what I'd add to it, I'd like to just see a little bit more of just sort of loss sharing further up the tower. I think it's a little bit too easy to be in a spot where, you know, depending upon how the tower is set up, where, you know, every dollar of loss after a certain threshold, you know, is laid upon the reinsurers. And I think to have terms and conditions that are more explicit in saying, look, you've got to hold some of this net a little bit higher up, I think would be useful in many cases. But obviously, it's going to be a case by case basis, and it's going to be much easier to do what Evelyn does than what I propose.
Thanks, Craig. Bernard, any thoughts on a specific area of terms and conditions you'd like to see change?
I think Evan took the important one there, and I agree with Craig too. I would turn it around and I would say, you know, if you're an ILS investor and you're investing through a fund manager, or you're investing through a structure like a sidecar, et cetera, typically you don't have access to the terms and conditions of the underlying contracts. And there are many, many reasons given as to why it is not possible to share that information. And I would like to see more transparency there. At the end of the day, it is investor capital that backs the risk. And I think there needs to be a lot more transparency on terms and conditions and across a portfolio if that's what you're invested in.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's something that most investors would definitely call for. We've actually got another question that I think would be interesting to hear your thoughts on now. I'm not sure if any of you specifically invest in life-related risks at all, but has COVID changed the way you as ILS investors would consider pandemic risk in terms of pricing, terms and conditions? And maybe we'll stick with you, Bernard, first.
It's a tough one. Definitely I think COVID is giving us all a sort of a lesson in what a pandemic really is and the ramifications of what a pandemic is. And therefore, I think we're getting educated as to, you know, how one might go about modeling the risk of a pandemic or, extreme mortality events. So I have not been involved recently in life transactions, so I really can't speak to in more details. But I think everyone's getting an education on the subject, more so than one would get looking at, the risk section of a life cat bond transaction. And, you're really getting a sense of what, the challenges of evaluating pandemic risk, et cetera. So I think it will definitely be taken into account in any ongoing pricing from now on, for sure.
Mm. And that's a good point, actually, Bernard, that we're all living through this, so we're all gaining real-world experience, which is only going to make investors and capital providers think again about backing that type of risk. Craig, I'm not sure whether you allocate outside of natural catastrophes. I don't believe you do, but is pandemic risk something that you now look at in a different light, given that we have experienced this?
No, we don't really do much outside of property cat. We mean, we have a few things that would be arguably more attritional in nature, but it's all in the P&C realm. We don't do really anything in life. So anything I say here is going to be of very, very limited credibility. I'll pass.
And I think it's probably the same for you as well, Evelyn, is it? That you're largely property cat. Yeah. Great. Well, we will move on. So we also have a question, and I was hoping to wrap up the session with some thoughts from you all on sort of Asia as an ILS market and whether it's important to you or not as an investor. And we actually have a question from the audience on what are your views on the need for diversification within your ILS portfolios and specifically in sourcing new perils or business from Asia as one example. And Evelyn, perhaps we'll start with you.
Well, I think in principle we're definitely open to that. I think there's when we look in our portfolio, we believe it's really important that risk is well modeled and that is well priced for. And if you have these two elements, I don't think there's anything. We're not waiting to then enter that market. I think today there's still some challenges also in these two, so both pricing as well as maybe building standards, but it's just a matter of time before that market will basically mature and then would be like a real candidate for an ILS investor to diversify their portfolios.
Yeah, a lot of ILS investors still take the approach of being quite concentrated in ILS because they're so diversified outside of ILS across the broader portfolio, I suppose. Craig, is that how you look at it at Future Fund? Is Asian risk something that you would like to get more access to if the pricing was better?
If everything else makes sense, the answer is yes. And you hit on the main point there, Steve, which is that we don't necessarily need to diversify the ILS portfolio. The ILS portfolio itself diversifies a much larger asset portfolio. So what we want is we want the best risk, the best pricing in this sector. We don't necessarily want to have, you know, to have something else that we think is going to be a net money loser just to diversify the portfolio isn't all that helpful. At the same time, it's very easy to draw a case of Asia in growing in terms of insured value, in terms of the potential for data gathering, the potential for for all of the modeling considerations that you'd want to have, the potential for an accumulation of risk that needs to be laid off someplace else, that can be done at mutual benefit for both the cedent and the reinsurer. So I think all of those components are absolutely in place for growth in the region over time. It's just a question of pricing and terms.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. You want the best risk at the best price. And I think that goes for any investor with any asset class, really, doesn't it? Bernard, what about you? Are you looking to access more diverse sources of perils if you could? Again, is it just pricing that really matters for you? And I guess also I'd ask you, what do you think about risks that come out of Asia, specifically out of Singapore and then in future Hong Kong? Does that make any difference to your investment decisions?
I'll go back to what Evelyn said, and if modeling and pricing are key components here, the risks must be quantifiable and the modeling must be credible, and the pricing must be in line with other risk pricing. If you take the nature of the event out on a risk unit basis, is it priced as well as any other cat risk? Those are the two key components. I think sort of the regulatory environments are important as well. Are these markets giving us the protections that we expect, et cetera? And ESG considerations also will, definitely have a say in any decision. But yeah, I mean, in principle, definitely open to, cat risk coming out of Asian cedents.
Mm. Well, that's positive for the market going forwards and hopefully for having capital interested in helping to develop the region as well. So, we've just run over the hour, so I'm going to draw things to a close there. So I'd like to say a big thank you to Evelyn, Craig and Bernard. Thank you all for your time today and sharing your thoughts with our audience. And for everyone who is watching, you will be able to catch up on this on demand in case you missed anything from it. And also all of the other sessions that have been on previously in this event as well. So thank you again, Evelyn, Craig, Bernard. Really appreciate you taking part today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.